want your soul.
This happened to me a few years ago when I was working for a small-time administration office as a security guard. The building had just been purchased by a company and was in a sad state of disrepair. So while there were no actual employees working in the building at the time, we had to be there to oversee some of the contractors working on it. It was a small team consisting of Jake, Miguel, and myself. While we didn't know each other prior to working there, the long hours meant that we got to know each other pretty quickly. Jake would tell us about his wife and kids, and Miguel would talk about his life growing up in Colombia. All in all, they were really good guys. Heck, we even met up for beers on the weekends sometimes. It was 6 days to Valentine's Day when Miguel and I received a call from head office. They told us that Jake wouldn't be coming in because he had been taken to the hospital the previous night with chest pains. Since he was only in his early 30s, Miguel and I assumed it was just a panic attack or something. But then later that day, we got the news that he had passed away at the hospital from a massive heart attack. The rest of the day was glum, to say the least. We asked if we could go home early as we both had become close to Jake, but we were told to stay until the plumber left. 2 days later, I called Jake's house looking for funeral information. The day after that, both Miguel and I carpooled to the church to attend. The ceremony was deeply Catholic, which was a little strange and foreign to me since I've always been an atheist, but Miguel seemed to be right at home, so I kept to myself. When the funeral was over, we went to the graveyard and watched them lower Jake's casket into the ground. Then, after giving out condolences to his grieving widow and children, we returned home. That night, I had trouble sleeping. I always do when I drink heavily before hitting the hay. Weirdly, I kept having dreams about our weekend bar visits with Jake, and even though everything about it was normal, Jake included, I knew in the back of my mind he was dead, and therefore the whole situation was wrong. As if to assure me that everything was fine, in the dreams, Jake was super attentive to me. He was there, his presence. He often asked, "What's wrong? You don't look so well," he would say, and things were as they normally were, except it was a dream. The next day, I considered phoning in sick due to the hangover, but decided against it because I got word that Miguel had already called in to say he would be staying home. I knew the security guards were easy to come by in the economy, so I went in to save face. I needed the job. Plus, there was unlikely to be any worker scheduled to come in, so I stopped for a coffee on my way. When I arrived, I was surprised to find another car in the massive parking lot. It was snowing pretty hard, so I didn't get a good look at it until I parked myself and approached the building. It was Jake's car. Even though it was strange, I shrugged it off. After all, I figured it was just Jake's wife, maybe here to collect some of his work things. Through the haze of the hangover, that seemed as likely as anything. But when I found the building locked up tight, I did steal a glance back at the car before pushing into the main entryway. It was dark as all the lights were off, except for an exit sign which cast a red glow over the scaffolding and tools strewn about. I moved behind the security desk and booted up the system so I could take a cursory look at the cameras. While it booted up, I took my jacket off and hung it up on the back of my chair and began to sip at my coffee. Once the 10 different views popped up on the screen, I began to scrutinize them one at a time. About halfway through the various camera views, something moved onto the last camera's sights and then quickly out again, and I barely caught it out of the corner of my eye. The last camera was set up in our shipping and receiving warehouse at the back of the building, which was a small track down a long hallway with no windows or doors and around a corner. Sighing, I got up and turned the light system on, journeyed down the hallway with my coffee in hand. The shipping room was a total mess from all the construction garbage that they had been loading into dumpsters in the back of the building, and there was less light due to the reliance on the large windows in the dreary morning. I moved in a full circle around the room, looking for a raccoon or something that may have slipped in to get out of the cold. But what I found was a whole lot of nothing, and a microwave the workers had set up for reheating their lunches. "Hello?" I called out for good measure. "Mrs. Galloway?" I added in case it was Jake's wife. When there was no answer, I was about to turn around and leave when I heard footsteps coming towards me down the long hallway. Thinking that it must be a worker or maybe Jake's wife answering my call out, I moved back that way. As I reached the end of the shipping and receiving doors, a figure moved around the corner from the long hallway. I couldn't believe my eyes, and neither could my hands apparently, as the coffee slipped right out from my grasp, splashing the hot liquid all over my sneakers. There, standing in his security uniform, was Jake. He was pale, even without the help of harsh fluorescent light, and his normally bright blue eyes were glazed over and unfocused. I opened my mouth to make a noise of astonishment, but my voice caught in my throat as his mouth fell open. His tongue rolled down over his bluish lips, wiggling like a worm, and his eyes suddenly snapped to focus on me. "What's wrong?" he slurred like a drunken man. I began to tremble and instinctively move backwards as the smell of rot and compost hit my nose. Jake's tongue retracted slowly back into his mouth as his face began to droop on the right side, his nostrils flaring up to triple their normal size. You don't look well," he stammered in a desperate, almost yelling tone as he took a shaky step towards me. Jake, you're dead," was all I could manage in a shaky whisper. "What's wrong?" he asked again, taking another shaky step as his face began to droop more and more. I tried to scream, but it came out as a low groan as Jake grew closer, his face looking more like a loose-fitting Halloween mask than an actual face. He reached his hands out for me as to embrace me in a hug and gargled, "You don't look so well." I ducked as his hands closed in and sprinted past him and out of the room. Although I didn't look back until I was in my car and speeding away, the whole way down the hallway I could hear his voice as if it was right beside me. "What's wrong? You don't look so well." That night, I called the office and quit the job and advised Miguel to do the same. When I looked into it, I discovered that Jake's grave was untouched and that his car had never left the driveway where he left it at home. I still don't know what he would have done if I would have let him grab me. After all, we were good buddies and I can't imagine that he would do anything to hurt me. I worry to this day that he was actually the one in pain, scared, just reaching out for a familiar face, but I don't regret running from him. I've made it a bit of a habit of leaving flowers on his grave every year, and generally the day after I do it, I have that same dream of the three of us back in the bar. While seeing him every year like that makes me uneasy, I just don't know what to make of what went on, and I have no idea where he is today. "Play with me," it said. I stirred in my bed, my eyes drowsy and heavy. A yawn blew out of my mouth. I was seconds away from falling deep into my dreams, but the voice shook me back to reality. "Play with me," it repeated, a child's voice. One that I came to recognize early in my childhood. I laid with my eyes still closed, denying the fact that I woke up. I still felt exhausted and at the verge of passing out. If I just relaxed a little longer... "Play with me," it muttered, but its tone somehow changed. It didn't come out with hostility, but somehow it snatched my attention immediately. It sounded hopeless and lost, and it felt as if those same feelings provoked me at that moment. I imagined my bed forming lips right before where I laid. For some reason, this image stuck to my brain. "Play with me. Play with me." The words continued to barrage my mind, leaving me restless and frantic. Now I wanted to open my eyes, but some mystical force kept them from splitting open. The lips on my bed moved and hummed. I felt the chilling vibration under where I laid. A tongue stretched out of its lips and licked my entire back. I tried moving my limbs, but just like my eyes, they remained paralyzed. "Play with me." The lips opened wide, and released a hot steam of breath. The air below scorched my entire body. My body sank deeper inside my bed, the sheets and comfort swallowing me whole. At this point, breathing became an impossible task. The oxygen surrounding me grew thin. Darkness consumed my sight. I opened my eyes. Everything remained still. Nothing seemed disturbed. Well, except for me, of course. From the window above my head, the moon shone its silver light through my blinds. My heart raced 1,000,000 miles per second. With the help of the moon, I managed to scan my entire room for anything suspicious. Everything appeared normal and intact, thankfully. Sweat drenched my entire body, making my pajamas and bedsheets stick to my skin like superglue. I thought about pulling away my blanket in order to cool myself down, but something told me it'd be better if I just laid underneath the sheets. Maybe it was my childish mind pretending that my blankets can actually protect me from any monster or demon. Oh, how I miss the innocence of my mind as a kid. The creepiness of what I just experienced settled my mind. I shivered deeply into my bed, despite how hot my body felt. Some traces of my memory told me that everything was just some sick and bizarre nightmare, but I knew better than that. At that point in my childhood, I dealt with my fair share of paranormal experiences. Play with me. This time I heard the child's tenuous voice loud and clear. As calm and as gentle as the child's tone sounded, it somehow pierced the silence inside my room like a sharp knife slicing through human flesh. Worst of all, it stimulated whatever emotion I felt the most at the moment. And currently, anxiety took hostage of my conscience. I peeked at the closet door that stood across from me. The moonlight provided full clarity of the entire wooden surface. Both doors remained closed, just how I left them right before I slept. A noise came from behind the closet doors. It sounded like someone or something shuffling in between my clothes. The first levels of trepidation kept my body at bay. I wanted nothing more than to run away, but the child's voice already drew me in with its mystical hands, and they refused to let me go. The door creaked open, the rusty hinges releasing a sour hiss, and the bottom of the closet door grinding against the hardwood floor. I rattled in my bed as if I was having a seizure. Each second that passed by stretched farther and farther. More movement occurred behind the shadows the closet door created. I struggled hard to gather my thoughts, but they scattered themselves and blew far away from my mind like pieces of paper against an autumn wind. Play with me. I heard the child better, now that the closet door didn't restrict the full volume of his voice. That was worse for me, however. I tried bottling in all of my terrified emotions, but the bastard broke the glass free and let my feelings spill out of my skin and bones like blood from an open wound. At this point, I thought I'd drown in my sweat. The child stepped forward. I heard the sound of his soft and delicate foot tap against the floor. I strained my eyes harder at the closet door, trying to catch a quick glimpse at the boy who had been disturbing my sleep for over a year now. Every time I try, however, I always failed. The child always hid himself amongst the shadows. He took his time approaching me, as if hesitant and fearful of my own presence. When this happened, I began feeling sympathetic towards the poor child. I reminded myself that every night he paid me a visit, he never tried to hurt or harass me. Sure, he sometimes scared the crap out of me, but this seemed unintentional. It was only my own head worried and paranoid about the unknown, nothing more. The child swayed closer to where I was laid. What more can I have done but just lay there and let the boy do as he pleased? Some of the nights the child crept out of my closet door, he spent most of his time gazing in my direction. Even though I couldn't tell if he even had eyes to look at me, I still sense his glare on my face. At first, this really freaked me out. I mean, who would enjoy being stared at as you try to sleep? But it almost felt as if he was guarding me from my own nightmares. But always, no matter what, he asked the same question over and over again. Play with me. I never responded back. I always just fell back to sleep or waited until the sun rose and the boy returned back to my closet or wherever the hell he came from. That night, however, I finally spoke back. "Okay," I whispered, my words leaving my lips like syrup drooling out of my mouth. "What do you want to play?" The boy stopped walking. I knew I surprised it somehow. The nervous energy that transpired between us almost felt like something tangible. I waited with patience to see what would happen next. The child shrilled and let out a loud shriek. I joined in on the screaming, as if trying to compete who can shout the loudest. Immediately after this, the boy's entire presence vanished from where he remained. But before the boy disappeared, I spotted something weird about him. See, the moment he left, a small flash of light emerged from where he stood. This granted my eyes just one split second to finally see what the child looked like. What I saw was far from what I expected. The first thing that caught my eyes was the boy's face. He looked pale as snow, and his lips appeared numb and blue. A small helmet of blonde hair rested on top of the boy's head. Dirt and grass was smeared all over the child's cheeks and forehead. The most distinctive feature, however, were the boy's hollow, demented eye sockets. They looked like two endless dark tunnels. The longer you gazed at the child's empty eyes, the more the shadows inside sucked you in. Right in the middle of the boy's body, just inside his intestines, remained a big blob of red and yellow light. A maze of veins glowed inside the boy's naked stomach. It almost seemed as if the child was pregnant. It took me a while to recognize him. Right before I realized who he was, I yelled until my throat began bleeding from the inside. It was Ricardo, my best friend who died when I was only 5 years old. This incident occurred when I was 6 years old. A lot has changed over the past 11 years, but to some extent nothing has changed at all. Sometimes the thing you least expect to end up happening does so after all. For instance, I never would have predicted that I would befriend the ghost that had been haunting my night since I was 5 years old, but I'll get to that in a bit. To explain the story, I guess I need to begin when my family and I moved to Union City around the turn of the 21st century. I was 2 at the time, still very young and naive to the many dangers that possesses the earth. The reason my family left New York and entered New Jersey instead was because of the death of their stillborn child. I was supposed to have an older sibling, but the child died during birth. It happens often, and nobody's to blame, really. My parents, however, couldn't properly deal with the shame and guilt of their first child dying. They became very unstable and reckless because of it. A month or so after the infant died, they immediately tried once more to make another child, I guess out of desperation. This is how I was brought into this world. I'm the result of 2 emotionally broken adults who relied on my birth to restore their hope in this world. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing for me, but either way I managed to survive this time. Even after my birth, however, my folks still carried weight of their deceased baby on their shoulders. They quickly left New York as soon as possible. They stated that the city and house they lived in constantly reminded them of their dead baby. All of my parents' neighbors and friends looked forward to the upcoming child at the time. When my folks informed everyone that the child never made it out of the womb alive, the disappointment that crossed their lives escalated to something morbid and pitiful. I claim myself a New Yorker, even though I lived most of my life in New Jersey. My parents often took me there since my father still worked at his job in the big city. They used to always take me near where they once lived and introduce me to all of their previous neighbors. I remember very distinctively how most of them glared and studied me. They thought of me as a child from heaven itself. They always littered me with gifts and provided special privileges for whatever I desired. I was always shy around them, so I never begged for anything, and at times the attention became overwhelming. During some of our trips, however, I began noticing the hidden depression in my parents' hearts once they spent a little too much time around their house. I once caught my mother crying inside one of her best friend's rooms when I was 4. When I approached her and asked her what was wrong, she simply shook her head, a water full of tears rushing down her red eyes, and took hold of my back and shoulders with her bare arms. My mother embraced me with a gracious hug and whispered in my ear how much she loves me and how lucky I am to be a part of her life. Her moist and warm face rubbed against my own cheeks. At some occasions, I would have found this annoying, but I sensed and empathized with my mother's pain even at such a young age. Even though I had no idea what the heck was going on, I still knew that I needed to hug my mother strongly in order to make her feel better. Despite the setbacks my parents faced, they somehow found a way to move forward. At such a young age, I learned to be grateful at the circumstances that passed through my life. Some parents might have fought and divorced each other if something this tragic ever shot at their lives. Some parents might have relied on drugs and alcohol in order to mellow out the agony dwelling deep in their hearts and souls. But my parents decided to act differently. They looked at me as inspiration and chose to dedicate their life to raising me right. They thanked God that I had survived and took it as a sign to make the best life for me. For this, I owe them all of my regards, and I can't be any more appreciative for what they've done. But nothing could have prepared the three of us for what hit me when I turned 5. My close friend from kindergarten passed away around that time. His name was Ricardo Hernandez. I knew this kid since I started school at the age of 4 in pre-K. We met there, and that same first day we instantly became best pals. I remember we couldn't remember our names the first few weeks, so we just each called each other amigo. It was adorable. As bashful as I was, I somehow managed to be comfortable with him only. We just clicked. I can't seem to explain it any other way. Ricardo died from breathing problems. I didn't quite know the specifics back then. I just knew that he needed to remove his tonsils. Ricardo's folks scheduled the appointment to proceed with the treatment as soon as they found out. I think a day or so before the surgery was supposed to happen, he died in his own bed while watching cartoons. The hospital told his parents that the dysfunction of his lungs wasn't anything that serious, but I guess they must have overlooked something important. Death has a way of messing with parents. If the Grim Reaper does exist, then that son of a bitch must have some grudge against my mother and father. They reacted with devastation at the news of my best friend's sudden death. They knew how close Ricardo and I became, and because of his friendship, my parents ended up befriending Ricardo's parents. Like any decent adult would do, my mother and father comforted and mourned with my best friend's parents together. I guess they also understood how it felt to lose a child at such a young age. This was just what my parents needed. Right when they finally overcame all odds and learned to live with the death of their infant son, life or God or whoever the hell finds some messed up way to remind my parents of their most stressful and dismaying point of their lives with another death. When I first found out about the news, the principal from my school visited our class and delivered the awful story. The day before this happened, the other students and I caught our teacher, Miss Ventra, crying and moping near the hallways. Out of all of her children, she cared and respected Ricardo the most. He always charmed our teacher in a way that amazed me as a young kid. His death really impacted us all. I mostly handled the situation with apathy, and I don't know if that makes me some emotionless monster or not. Children understand a lot despite their age, and I was fully aware of what happened to Ricardo. All of my classmates were. He died, and he was never coming back. This fact stuck to our brains, and nothing would be able to take it away. Don't get me wrong, I did feel like crap on the inside. I lost my only friend who brought something out of me. I really didn't get along with all the other kids. It's not like they bullied me or anything, but I just chose to isolate myself from them. What got to me the most was witnessing my parents circle around a difficult depression once again. For the next month or so, the environment inside my house consisted of nothing but gloom and hopelessness. Every time I walked inside, I just sensed the sadness seeping into my head and emotions. My mom and dad tried encouraging everyone to feel better, and sometimes I actually believed that we were healing from this tragic point in our lives. But at the end of these futile attempts, we're met with everyone giving up. I felt disgusted with my parents and myself. A year or so after Ricardo's death, I began experiencing these unexplainable paranormal interactions. They began around the time I was 6. Late one night, I think it was Saturday, I was snuggled in my bed with the lights off. I was playing my Nintendo Game Boy Advance at the moment. I don't remember what time it was exactly, but I'm more than certain it was past midnight. I made sure to stay quiet since at this time my parents were already sleeping. I started to feel tired after an hour or so playing Pokemon Sapphire. My eyes kept on opening and closing, and I took this as a sign to go to sleep. Right before I could even turn off my device, I heard the faintest of sounds coming from my closet. This aroused me instantly, and whatever sleepiness I felt before vanished. Bewilderment took over that exhaustion. I waited for the noise to come again. After a minute or so in suspense, I didn't realize I was holding my breath anymore. I held my Game Boy above my face, the screen flashing its colorful lights on my eyes. I pressed start and saved my game, but I didn't turn off my device. I needed it as a source of light. I aimed the device towards my closet door and waited for something to happen. Anything. A loud bump sounded off behind the doors. I dropped my Game Boy right on my face. Ouch! I winced and rubbed my nose. A jolt of pain spread all over my face. Play with me, I heard for the first time. I laid paralyzed with apprehension. The sting on my nose suddenly seemed less important. For the first few seconds, I remained confused and a bit unnerved. Then that confusion evolved into frustration for not understanding what just happened. From frustration, I grew distressed and paranoid. Suddenly, the shadows inside my room seemed too dark. The walls appeared too thick. My blankets choked me a little bit too much. The pillows below my face felt as if they were suffocating me, and the whole world was going against me. The paranoia fused with the worst of my fears. I went to scream, but my throat locked in itself. The inside of my mouth grew dry. I thought about jumping out of my bed, but dismissed that idea. Like any normal child, I resorted to my blankets for comfort and safety. I remember burying my body deep inside my sheets and refusing to open my eyes. Nothing else happened after that, however. I stood awake for most of my time there, and when I woke up, I suffered from a tremendous headache. But other than that, I remained undamaged and sane. I prevented myself from confronting my parents about this. They were already dealing with enough, and if I just told them about my weird and creepy experience, I would just bring them even more things to worry about. And besides, nothing bad happened to me. That was what mattered the most. The next week came and the same thing happened again. This time, however, I maintained a bit more of my composure. I still felt my terrified thoughts crawling into my mind, but it wasn't as unbearable as before. I mostly felt speculation. A part of me wanted to say it was a ghost, but being that young, I still knew how ridiculous that sounded. Strange things like that only happen in movies or in novels. For the next week and on, I spent most of my time pondering about what I was dealing with. I analyzed everything, from the time the apparent ghost decided to sneak in my room, to the movement and sounds it made. I came to several conclusions after 3 months of thinking everything through. The first thing I came up with was that it was indeed some form of a ghost, spirit, or whatever you want to call it. The second thing was that it wasn't an it, but a he. It took some time coming to this conclusion, but it was obvious. The voice said it all. It sounded light and ethereal, yes, but it contained a bit of roughness that only boys can pull off. One of the most important factors I put into consideration was that it never once tried to inflict damage upon me. That stopped me from making it a problem. Not only that, but this fact alone slowly made me adapt and accept the presence of this young child. My mind still wrestled with the fear of being stalked, but this was only natural for anyone, especially a young boy like myself. No matter what, I was still talking to the dead. If that doesn't bring chills down your spine, then you're not a human. The more knowledge I gained about the apparition, however, the more questions bombarded my mind. I told myself it would be a horrible idea to take physical notes about my experience. If someone were to take hold of that notebook and read everything through, they would assume I was either a child with amazing imagination or some type of enigmatic maniac. And seeing how my reputation in school came to be being the quiet, awkward, and slow kid, I didn't think people would guess the former. So, at the end, I was forced to remember and repeat everything I learned over and over in my head. It became arduous and onerous at first, but this helped form my expansive memory. That came in handy during school, but during that time, school was the last thing I worried about. The night finally came that after over 3 years of hearing but ignoring the ghost, I finally responded back. And to my amazement and shock, I ended up finding out it was my best friend Ricardo this whole time. It all made perfect sense. This changed everything. That night I stood up until early dawn. It was not of sheer terror, however, but out of an overwhelming sense of happiness. For once, this world didn't seem like a place where you shoved along as more shit piled up in your life, but it became something beautiful and rewarding. Somehow, I reunited with my first and only ever friend, and that's all I cared for. The shift in my mood and attitude was unbelievable. Even my parents were astonished. I ignored the fact that my best friend looked like he crawled right out of his grave. I mean, I knew that I saw him, and I knew he looked in terrible condition, but I didn't care. I never realized how much I missed and cared for him until he returned back to my life. From that point on, I began contacting the ghost more often. He started visiting me in the night several times a week instead of once every weekend. We both talked, and the longer this happened, the more it seemed as if he was really Ricardo. The way he acted and everything he said just seemed like it fitted Ricardo's personality. I couldn't hardly believe it. I never saw him in his physical form ever again, though. Every time we grouped up, he was always invisible. I could never touch or see him like before when we were kids in preschool, but I was able to feel him. I think that was made him so special to me. It didn't matter that he would never be able to play like this before. The warm and tender presence he offered was enough to satisfy me. I remember one night when we were together, I broke down in front of him. I just released all of my frustration and sorrow into my tears, and I couldn't stop crying. But it was also a weird mix of happiness and sadness. For one thing, getting Ricardo back was something I appreciated every day. I don't know what purpose it served, but I never took my friend for granted from that point on. But at the same time, I faced the horrors of school and my social life. Nobody liked me, and I faced bullies every time I entered that building. I just couldn't associate myself well with those other kids. I saw nothing in common with everyone else, and every time I attempted to speak to one of them, they glared at me with disgust and dissatisfaction. The hate on their faces was just so obvious. I did everything wrong in school, and for that reason everyone called me a failure and a mistake. And I kept on thinking that if Ricardo was with me, he could have been the person who I could have depended on for kindness. I wish those other kids died instead of my own best friend. Why did Ricardo have to die? Why did my family and I always have to endure the grief of death, while everyone else remained untouched by the Reaper's menacing hands? It wasn't my fault that I couldn't get along with those other damn kids. So much had happened to me that I felt the need to isolate myself. Right when I wanted to crawl out of my shell and become one with my school, they rejected me and treated me like shit. The best thing about Ricardo's ghost was that he understood. That night as I drowned in my own tears, he wrapped me around a therapeutic aura and suddenly everything felt better. My deepest sorrows washed away and was replaced by an ocean of tranquility. All of my muscles eased up, the sting on my eyes mitigated and my head felt relaxed. He kept me locked around his comfortable aura even as the first rays of morning light slipped through my open curtains. This startled me. Ricardo has never stood up this late with me, and I knew he felt aversive towards any type of light. I tried wiggling away from his presence and told him to leave now before anything bad happens to him. But he kept me secured and whispered to my ear that he was going to be all right. Even then, I wanted him to leave. My greatest fear was losing Ricardo again. But he told me to trust him, and that trust is the true foundation to any friendship. Ricardo said that true friendship is giving someone the key to your destruction and trusting them to not abuse you with that sacred knowledge. So I listened and followed what he said. For the first time, I trusted someone outside of my family. And when dawn rose up and I saw how Ricardo remained the same, I knew then and there that I didn't need anyone else in my life. As long as I had Ricardo, my one and only true best friend, I could survive in this world. That's why, when he abandoned me the moment I entered high school, I almost killed myself. It never made sense to me. He just left without a hint of where he would be. I told Ricardo everything, from my darkest secrets to how I felt truly about this world, and he departed off with my trust within his grasp. He disappeared, and when he left, Ricardo took a part of me with him. I felt so disconnected with myself. We raised each other together. Throughout my whole life as a young child growing up into a teenager, he has been there for me every step of the way. Every bully I fought, every girl that denied my love, every person that refused to be my friend, Ricardo was there to witness it all. I knew the consequence I would face if Ricardo and I tried stabilizing our friendship in this world. Nobody would believe me that I was talking to the kid who died out of lung failure in kindergarten. People would just see me as a weirdo, and to be honest, I wouldn't blame them. I mean, it was pretty weird. Sometimes I needed to pause from my own distorted reality and really take in the fact that the person I loved the most was a ghost. It felt natural to me, but I knew that from an outside perspective, it would be the craziest shit ever. But I thought it would be worth it, you know, separating myself from everyone else. I'd come to like the fact that I was unique and that I had something, or better yet, someone, that nobody else had. This helped rebuild my confidence and made me a more assertive person when I entered middle school. I still kept to myself, but I no longer felt inferior among my classmates. In fact, I settled into this hubris personality that I found everyone to be pieces of shit that didn't deserve my companionship. The only people who mattered to me was my family and Ricardo. Everyone else could burn in hell for all I care. Ricardo helped create some of the best moments of my life. He was always the imaginary best friend who I jumped along the couch with. Ricardo and I played with our variety of toys, and we always used to act out these wild ideas in our heads. It was always a fun time with him. My parents grew a bit worried about my mental state around the time I was 11 or 12, and I was still pretending I was talking with an imaginary best friend. They thought I was a bit too old for that. Not only that, but it didn't help that I had no other friends, and that they never saw me with any one of my classmates. I never invited anyone over, so they knew the type of reputation I gained from school. Placing all of these factors together, I can't blame them for thinking that I was, in some type of way, a little psychotic. One time the three of us talked about it, and I gave them some of the honest truth of my situation. Of course, I didn't mention the fact that my old friend Ricardo was living with us, but I informed them that I really hated everyone in school and that I had no friends. But I told them I didn't mind, and that I found a way to have fun all by myself. I explained that I relied on my imagination in order to cope with the fact that nobody liked me, and that sometimes I went overboard and actually thought my characters came to life. I made a deal that I would stop talking to myself if it really freaked them out. My parents agreed, and in the end they were very understanding. They had an idea that my childhood really messed me up, so it was okay if I behaved the way I did. They accepted my weirdness, and for this, I loved them even more. But they didn't need to worry about anything. Later on, as I stated before, Ricardo left me. In a way, this was worse when he actually died in kindergarten. I had this idea in mind that I would enter high school and that I would dread those awful 4 years there. I knew that I needed to prepare myself for all the harassment, all the fights, all the unwanted attention, and everything else that made my life a total pain in the ass. But I knew that at the end of the day, I would have Ricardo to pick me up whenever someone knocked me down. So when he left me to deal with everyone's crap in that school, I died inside. I felt so betrayed and alone, and this resulted in my worst behavior. I started the fights with the other kids, and I made sure I never backed down. Even when I almost punched a kid to death, I felt no remorse. The rational switch inside me flicked off, and I unleashed all my frustration and pain towards anyone who had the audacity to ruin my day. Ricardo leaving me really ruined me. My brain felt as if someone completely changed every function of it. I couldn't think right and forget about sleeping. I became a chronic insomniac. My world became a mess yet again. So that was my life the first 3 years in high school. Entering my senior year, I didn't care at all anymore. I didn't know what direction my life was heading towards, but I just couldn't care. I became this placid and dull adolescent. I wasn't scrambling fights with bullies, but at the same time I stopped myself from starting new relationships with other people. I trusted nobody because of Ricardo. So when he introduced himself to me once again last week, it turned my world upside down. What timing. Out of all the times he could have re-entered my life, he chose now, right when I stopped caring about my own existence, right when I completely forced him out of my thoughts and emotions. He decides to whisper his signature catchphrase and act as if he hadn't left me for 3 years filled with nothing but despair and suicidal thoughts. Why couldn't he have come when I behaved like a jerk in high school? Where was he when I returned home from the outside world, with tears flooding down my eyes, wishing that I could just change the way my life turned out? Why couldn't he have come help me when I had the tip of the knife just an inch away from the vein on my wrist, ready to slice my flesh open and drown in my own blood as I bathe in my tub? Where was he then? No, he doesn't deserve a warm-hearted homecoming. I know he plans on visiting me this upcoming weekend. As much as I should be happy, he needs to know how much I suffered. I at least deserve an apology. I still care for Ricardo, but he and I know that we need to talk this through. A lot has changed since then. I'm more than prepared for this. All I can do now is wait and be patient. He better hope I'm in a good mood that night. Saturday night arrives. I lay on my bed with a book beside me. The small lamp next to me blares a faint and white light. I've spent the past 3 hours reading this novel and wasting time on my phone. I've kept on checking the time, and as the hour clock moved from 9 into the night to 10, then to 11 and finally to 12, I grew a bit anxious. It feels as if parasites infected my stomach and are now crawling in and out of my organs. As nervous as my head and body gets, however, I know I must demonstrate nothing but temerity. I can't shy away now. That part of my life ended a long time ago. My parents chose the perfect weekend to leave the house for a quick getaway. That way, if things start to get hectic between Ricardo and me, there are no restrictions as to how loud and aggressive I can get. I plan to handle this with maturity, but that doesn't change the fact that I can't make him feel guilty for what he's done. I place my novel on the top of my nightstand and flick the lamp off. Darkness envelopes my bedroom like a pool of shadows. The moon shoots a tiny glimmer of light right at the center of my bed. This should be enough for me to feel comfortable. "Come out," I command. I started sensing him the moment it hit 11:30. For a while, I fought with my nerves and fears pulsing out of my mind like a horde of bees trying to escape their hive. I knew I needed to end this influence over my feelings. I couldn't allow him to manipulate me any longer. I'm giving silence and nothing more. I focus my eyes better on the closet door. I feel him behind those barriers, so why does he hesitate? He must be aware of how disappointed I am. I don't blame him. If I was in his position, I would think twice about confronting me now too. I open my mouth, but before I could say more, the closet door slides open. I choke on my distasteful words and swallow them. They taste bitter. I sit upright and place my pillow against the wall behind me in order to be more comfortable. I feel his opposing force of emotions trying to break through the defensive wall I built against him. His effort proves futile, however. All this tension passing between us actually makes me sweat. My back begins to drench itself, and the corners of my mouth grow so dry they form tiny blisters. I don't know how long I can maintain this. Ricardo takes his time approaching me, his soft and almost quiet footsteps taunting me each time they land on the floor. As some people might assume, I might be a little gay for my best friend. I mean, I've only spent my entire life with him alone, and I never went on a date before with any girl. I find both genders attractive in a way, but Ricardo obviously catches my attention the most. The way he's treated me with love is what finally made me realize everything. If me loving a dead ghost doesn't convince you how messed up I am, I don't know what will. My ghost friend finally reaches the edge of my bed. Although I can't see him, I feel him. I feel him near. He stands still. The silence overcoming my ears becomes unbearable. I'm able to hear the quiet sound of my impulsive heartbeat, and then I start to hear a small ringing noise deep inside my eardrums. I tap on the wall behind me in order to rappel against the quietness. If I took that any longer, I would have shot my brains out. Ricardo begins to climb on top of my bed. I want to say something, anything. I want to stop him and start talking to him about what he did. But the idea of both of us sitting down face to face intrigues me more. There, he could witness the anguish in my eyes. The sheets on top of my bed rustle as he crawls closer to where I remain. I start to shiver. My breathing increases and the pressure on my chest feels like a ton of bricks slammed down my lungs. I'm sweating bullets at this point. The world surrounding me blurs, and all that remains clear is the image stretching larger and larger as the seconds drift by. I almost start to feel hypnotized by my own mind and its hallucinations. Ricardo stops right where the moonlight hits my bed. That little line of light shines directly on his face. Death is written all over his expression. It's the same image that I saw back then as a kid, but this time he seems to have aged, oddly. Pieces of his once pale and soft flesh now dangle from his cheekbones. Some parts of his face appears rotten and deteriorated by the time, the skin ruddy and infected. Black slime swirls inside his mouth. Ricardo's devilish grin colored with waste and worms. Parts of his hair have fallen off, and I'm able to see his bony and disfigured skull. Several bumps and warts decorate the area around his forehead and chin. And of course, the worst of all, his eyes. Ricardo's hollow and lifeless eyes that sucks the youth right out of your soul. "What the heck happened to you?" I ask, horror-stricken. The longer I gaze at his current physical state, the more it dawns upon me how I never had my best friend back in the first place. Or better yet, this wasn't Ricardo at all. What the heck is going on? "You idiot," Ricardo whispers, but this time his voice soothes out of its brusque throat with a deep and monstrous tone. Black and demonic tentacles begin to sprout out of his corpse. They drip with black blood and seem as sharp and deadly as a dagger. Something else emerges from behind Ricardo's dead body. Before I can pay attention to what it is, I'm distracted when those black whips slither closer to where I sit. They tangle around my limbs, neck, and body. A silent cry escapes out of my trembling lips, and before I could shout for help, for anybody to please help me, one of the vines closes around my mouth. I try yelling through the thick and moist tentacles, but all I manage to produce is a low, muffling sound. Ricardo pulls me closer to where he sits. I shove and wiggle my shoulders and legs, but the more I try to fight, the more the vines tighten. I feel the blood circulation on my bare arms and legs end. The tight knot tied around my neck begins to crush my throat. I figure I would be panicking, but at the moment I feel nothing but a loss of hope. "I won," the ghost says, although he no longer sounds like a little boy. His voice makes the bed and walls shake for God's sake. "I won, and there's nothing you can do about it." All I can do is glare at his empty eyes and wonder whether a piece of my friend dwells inside this demonic creature or not. "I can't believe I was able to outplay you like this," the spirit screeches, and then emits a low and gurgling laughter. "You're such an idiot. I thought you would notice later on, but no. I made a fool out of you. Even now you have no idea what's going on," this demon mocks me. "But I can't blame you. After all, you forgot about me, just like Mommy and Daddy forgot about me right when they had you." "No. No way. This cannot be." "Ah, you realize now, huh? I see it in your eyes. You're getting an idea of who I truly am." Ricardo's stomach begins to glow a tenuous yellow and white light. "I'm what could have been. I'm a rejected soul that not even God wished to bring into heaven. Nobody cares about me, and my life means little to nothing compared to all the other babies who lived. Sounds familiar, don't it? Do you know who I am now, huh? Do you, brother?" "No, I knew it, but I didn't want to believe it. I don't even know what to think right now. All I can do is feel. I feel my dead baby brother's emotions and his rage that erupts out of his heart like lava from an active volcano. The determination to hurt me burns through my skin, and I see the passion in his eyes despite there being just hollowness inside. Right when Mommy and Daddy had you, they already thought about forgetting about me, he grumbles. At first they still mourn my death, and that at least kept me content. But the older you grew, the more they left me out of their thoughts. You became the child they always wanted, and you stole their attention from me. Soon they completely abandoned me and only chose to think about you. Did my life mean nothing to them? Was I just a failure to them that they wanted to forget about? Why couldn't I have lived? Why did I have to be you and not me? He said. I wanted to speak. I wanted to tell him that they never forgot about him, that they use his death as an inspiration to make me a better child and them better people. I need to tell him that without him, I wouldn't be who I am now. Our parents, love us both equally. But just that thinking about him resurrected too many dark and agonizing memories. But I couldn't say any of that. All I could do is listen and feel his anger. I knew I couldn't leave without making the three of you suffer. I needed my revenge. This was when I began plotting my vengeance. I wanted you all to die. So I began visiting you little by little. I gave off subtle signs of my presence, but it wasn't enough. As a baby, you didn't care about me at all. I needed to wait for the perfect time to execute my plan. Then you entered school, and you became friends with that Ricardo kid. The demon in front of me chuckles. Ah, I knew I won after that. I had it all planned out. The doctors were right, you know. His lung condition wasn't all that serious. He just needed minor surgery, that's all. But you know, I have a way of interfering with other people's lives. I guess you could say I paid Ricardo a visit while he was watching cartoons and did what I had to do. My brother is a sick bastard. I never felt so furious in my life before. I kicked and thrashed around, giving every punch and swing all of my strength, not caring if my bones began to snap and my muscles started to tear. Even as blood leaks out from my wounds, the tighter his grip becomes, I don't care. This piece of scum murdered a kid, my best friend. He caused one of the greatest depressions in my life, and now he deserves to rot. Stop your efforts now, Steven, he commands. It's useless. I've won and you can't overpower me. You're weak. You've grown strong and confident, yes, but compared to me, you're still a pathetic kid who can't stand for himself. You freak. Being attracted to your own brother, for God's sake. You make me sick, he said. I managed to wiggle my hand out and flip him off. Childish as always, I see, the demon complains. Just like Ricardo. Anyways, I knew in order for my plan to work, I needed to gain your trust. And what better person could you trust and love other than the only friend you ever have in your entire life? Wow. You're such a loser. At least I would have made more friends. I knew you'd trust me, and that you'd be so infatuated with me. I knew that you would suffer in school, and that you'd rely on me to comfort you, and I did. I made sure you fell in love with me, and that I guided you towards a better life. I played you. You should be humiliated by how badly I have messed up your life, he explained. And I knew. I knew it would be perfect to just leave you right when you enter high school. Don't like being left alone, huh, Steven? Hurts like one mean bitch, doesn't it? Now you know my pain. It felt so great watching as you broke down, and as your life turned to crap. I kept on laughing and laughing at your own demise. Even our parents' depression brought much amusement. I made you suffer, and now I return. His corpse began to levitate. The blob of light inside his stomach grew brighter, and little by little the skin of his abdomen started to become transparent. I'm able to see the inside of his stomach, and I see. Oh God. Oh God, I'm gonna be sick. It's a fetus, camped inside his intestines. I come back to finish what I started, the demon child informs me, and now I realize that this whole time the voice had been coming from the stomach, the belly of the beast. It's been fun watching you grow up, but now your life must end here. How does it feel to just realize that your whole life has been one giant lie? How does it feel knowing that after your death, our parents come next? How does this feel, Stephen? Does it burn? Well, you better get used to it, because I'm going to send you exactly where our parents send me. Straight into nothingness. His corpse floats above me. More vines crawl out of his body. They all attach to my skin and begin to push my body deep into the mattress. I keep on fighting to free myself, but my brother is able to produce more and more of those tentacles. Soon, my entire figure from head to toe is webbed around his colony of whips. But the figure behind the ghost that I saw before earlier grows larger. I don't know what the heck that is, but whatever it may be, it feels strong and intimidating. Right at the center of my bed, a black hole rips open. I feel a sudden drop. My eyes open wide as I descend farther and farther away from the corpse. A wall of darkness surrounds me and begins to close around my eyesight. A gush of air forces me deeper inside whatever place I'm being sent to. I feel several hands reach up from below and grip my shirt and pants. Those thousands of hands dig their nails deep inside my skin, past the cloth of my clothing, and drag me deeper inside this prison of shadows and calamity. More and more of those invisible arms stack on top of my body and place more pressure on my muscles and skin. I feel like the victim of a king cobra. At the end, I don't feel anything anymore. Well, I mean on the inside I don't. No emotions, no fears, nothing. Just pity. I pity the fact that I had this life to live. Since birth, my life has been filled with nothing but depression and wickedness. I guess I've always been destined to live this way and have it end like this. Even when I thought I had some type of profound hope to hold on to and call it my own, I end up finding out it's all been a lie that led to my eventual fatality. But I'm fine if my life continues on after death, and I end up living with nothing but darkness and nothingness, as my brother stated. Hell, that's all I know at this point. I won't have to make that big of an adjustment. If only my brother could have let me talk, though, maybe I could have saved the both of us. I could have told him how much I love and cared for him, and how I've always understood his pain. I could have told him that we can work this out and find our own way to overcome whatever anger dwells inside the both of us. But he didn't let me talk, and because of that, he ended up screwing himself over. Because I could have also told him that Ricardo's real ghost was standing right behind him the entire time, waiting for the perfect moment to kill him. Go get him, amigo. In the middle of the dazed garden stands this four-storied cadaver of a building. Years ago, it was home to many residents, a couple of families, a few students, and some retirees. Now the house is nothing more than a decrepit panorama for bleak clouds. Wild toad flax spreads through the splintered masonry, covering its windows with ladylike fingers. Some branches diffuse through cracks and windows, others back upwards across the roof tiles, dangling on the other side like marionettes. Ornamenting this somber palette of ossified colors, the house has lulled itself to sleep with memories of its past, not even disturbed by thuds of dry acorns on the cracked cemented path. Time has stopped here. Every now and then, curious passerbys press their foreheads against the rusty gates of the garden, desperately squinting through the mist. None dare to climb over and enter. You too have been passing by, peeking through the gates, wondering about the empty garden and the house. And like everyone else, you too never dared to enter. Until now. With your face pressed against the gates, you notice something in one of the second floor windows. It's a speck of light, a really tiny one. You cup your hands and squint through the mist, and there it is again. What is that all about? You wonder. After all, the house has been abandoned for 30 years now, and to your knowledge, no one ever set foot inside since. That's when curiosity finally prevails over apprehension and common sense. And so you make that decision. You look around to make sure no one is watching you. You climb on top of the gate, carefully making your way above its Gothic serration, then jump 7 feet down on the cemented path of the garden. The light in the window still shimmers, flashing its gaze like a beacon from an abandoned lighthouse. Slowly, you make your way along the forking path, through the garden towards the house. Your steps are quiet and soft, as if you are not trying to wake a sleeping banshee. You pass by the fountain bench, noticing some random penchants of the past, a book that must have been left by a scatterbrained resident, a gardener glove tucked between moldy pebbles. The ghastly mist disperses as you reach the entrance of the house. You stomp your feet to shake juniper needles off of your shoes, and that's when you hear it. It's the house, cringing in its sleep. As you put your foot on the first stair, you can feel it breathe faster and shift eyelids side to side. It must be finally noticing your presence. Second stair, and the house no longer reacts to squeaks, but only shivers with its myriad of entangled spiderwebs. Like a comatose patient, it momentarily opens its eyes, gapes around with multiple eye sockets, and then falls back into a vegetative slumber. One flight of stairs, and the door to your left is the one you need. It's not locked. You try to push, and after a few tries, the door finally huffs and gives in. Swarms of microscopic dust specks perform pirouettes around you in all directions before fading from sight, beckoning you, the intruder, to enter the sanctuary presided by darkness. You hesitate, but you step in. You light a match, and molecules of light bounce off the walls, revealing the long corridor, seemingly longer than the building itself. How? Oh wait, there's another door to your left. You try the knob, but it's locked. Next to the door, you notice a coat rack with nothing on it, but a little headscarf. Then to your right, you see what looks like a kitchen with a bathroom pod and piles of some debris. Don't go in there, just keep on walking straight. The corridor soon ends, and you come face to face with a wide set of double doors. This time you open them with ease. Welcome to the living room. Whatever sunlight penetrates through the dappled window is not enough for you to see anything. You light another match and look around. You see rows of books with eroded titles stacked on shelves, then further down an open piano looking like a smiling imbecile with missing front teeth, then a carcass of what once was a desk with random wood planks covering its frame, a sooty glass vase and armchair facing the other way. Wait, you think you see someone sitting in that armchair. You hold your breath. Who's there? You whisper. Taking cautious sideways steps, you walk around, maintaining a distance of few feet between yourself and the figure in the armchair. You can hear your own heart pounding against your chest cage. Trickles of sweat run down your brows, and you don't notice the match burning your fingertips. You twitch and lick your finger. You pick your last match. Yes, yes, only one left in the matchbox. You nervously rub it against the side of your matchbox 3 or 4 times until it finally draws aerial hues in the air. As the sulfur light once again illuminates the living room, you find yourself standing right in front of that someone. That someone is still sitting in the armchair. That someone is still looking right at you. That someone is me. I am a girl about 6 or 7 years old. I live here. Those are my books, and that vase belongs to me, too. I tried learning piano once, only to be driven away by its constant throaty mocking of my poor skills. I gave up, and now the piano is nothing but a quiet observant to my daily routine. Speaking of routine, it consists of seating in this old armchair, leaning my palms on the armrest, swooning in and out of existence. My whole existence is in waiting. What do I wait for? I wait for her, the elderly woman who lives in the other room. I wait for her to call upon me, to invite me. And so I sit, and I stare at the dim window, looking from the rear side of the building. There are trees that grow there, and from time to time I see blotchy specks of sunlight slicing through the evergreen maze of conifers. Other than that, nothing is happening. No visitors and no occasional intruders, only in my imagination, including you. Evening creeps in, drawing strange gallows in the ceiling. When it gets darker, I hear thousands of voices oscillating through the corridor, in the room, in the imbecile piano, in the armchair. The voices, cognizant of my presence, intensify like a pendulum in reverse motion, calling me by my name. These are the voices of the yore, of places and sounds and smells, names long forgotten, eclipsing slowly like smoldering grass. This quiet peace is only disturbed by the clamor of dripping faucet in the kitchen every hour and pacing of the elderly woman in the adjacent room. She paces from one corner to another. I dare not enter her room, not until she calls me. And that's when I suddenly hear it. First it sounds like a distant, ah. There it is again, this time a bit more pronounced. I move towards the door of my sanctuary, my living room. I stand by the doorstep, and I hear it again, this time much clearer. Child. That cannot be a mistake, it's her. Goodbye, piano, goodbye, armchair, goodbye, books. I float down the corridor, gently caressing the ceiling with my hair. As I come closer to the bedroom, the voice resonates with overlaying echoes, like this. Cha-cha-cha-cha-child. And dormant echoes retort to her in their peculiar unison. The door to her bedroom is locked, but it isn't locked for me. I open and I float into her room, hovering above the floor like an apparition. Faint light from a lantern, situated on a nightstand, is enough to only uncover a few feet of the room, and one may wonder if this is the same light that beacons through the window, inviting adventurous intruders. As I enter the old woman's room, I gaze through the sumptuously finished room, down the arabesque wall tapestry with arching necks of draped chandeliers. I've never been here before, and my childish curiosity takes over. Below the tattered decorations of oval coving, I notice old photographs hung on manifold nooks. The aura above the lantern gives some unwanted colors to the otherwise black and white photographs. I notice sallow inscriptions in the corner of each photograph. I try to read it first, but I hear a voice reading it for me. Jacob F. Haynes. I turn to the far corner of the room where the voice came from. It must be her, the elderly woman sitting in the armchair in the dark corner of the room. Jacob F. Haynes, says the voice again. That's the name of the photographer, the person who took that photo. The first photograph on the right was taken in March of 1932. Me and my brother Henry, the very year he died. We grew up in a much larger house by the Delmar Gardens off Morgan Street, a big patio with... There's that patio in that photograph to the left. Her croaky sentences finally cease, and I can feel her shivering stare through the brown darkness. I can hear her taking loud sips of breath between words like ebb and tide of an ancient ocean. If I take another step, I will see her face, but she stops me and commands to take a seat on the ottoman. My name is Adrian, she says. I was only 9 when Henry died. She pauses to repel the sudden onslaught of painful memories, then takes a deep breath and slowly goes on. Henry, my brother Henry, was always an ill boy. But before the Great Depression hit, it was not something we worried about. Father's business was booming. We had access to the best specialists. We had enough money for expensive prescriptions. Then the Great Depression came, and the businesses that we owned slowly but surely went up in smoke. The photograph in the upper left, yes, that's the one. It's my father in front of our old house. We sold it the next year. I cried. So did my mother, even when she tried to soothe me. That is when we moved here, to the second floor apartment in this residential building. This is my room, mine and Henry's. He slept right there, exactly at the same spot where those photographs are. While we tried to make ends meet, his disease only got worse. Doctors gave it a medical name, polio. Other doctors gave it a scary nickname, plague of the century, and they told my father that Henry had to be hospitalized. Henry died on Christmas Day, his body weakened from numerous childhood illnesses. Could not withstand any other challenges. He was lucky. I knew he was. Others like him that I saw in the hospital lived on. Children of his age, some older, some younger. They were being placed in wooden boxes where nurses stimulated their lungs to breathe. They called it iron lungs. It was supposed to save them, but it only inflicted more pain, and Henry never went through that. He was lucky. He died peacefully on Silent Night. She stops again. Emotions must have combed through her throat, weakening tongue muscles for a moment, but she knows she has very little time left, and her words, like columns of blind men, meander towards me, never breaking formation. That photograph in the middle is of me and my mother in 1944 at the train station, few days after we received the Western Union telegram from Adjutant General, who was deeply saddened to inform us that my father, who was previously reported missing in action, was killed in Holland. The day after we received the death telegram, I informed my mother that I was joining the military. She did not try to dissuade me. I remember her look, like an abyss staring back at you. We stood at the train station and posed for one final photo, for 30 cents. That photo right there, and then I was off on a train to the naval base in Newfoundland, then across the Atlantic to tread on the battlegrounds where my father fought once, a military nurse, Army Nurse Corps, blue khaki, olive uniforms. Then the war was over. The photograph below, that's me in Paris, 1945, late spring, flowers that they used to sell only on Rue de Lyon. His door with the cowboy ring that made me laugh. I can hear it. That putrid stench of the nearby canal. I can smell it. The loaves he baked for me was shelled peas. He called it poise pain. I can taste it. And the way he looked at me when I came by their family bakery and rang that cowbell and asked for another poise pain and the secret single that only he and I shared. For another poise pain. And the secret signal that only he and I shared. I cherished it. The alcove where we met under the pillows of lilac and my name that he pronounced so funny. Adrienne. It made me smile. The letters we wrote to each other with those strange curves he would put above vowels that made his handwriting so special. And then our dreams, our funny dreams that whirled in the air, tap danced on monastery towers before dispersing in the lagoon sky. She looks at the tall clock on the other side of the room. It doesn't work, and she knows that, but old reflexes are hard to break. She coughs, and hollow echoes play parrot with her. 1947. The photograph on the top right. Me back in this apartment after 3 years of being away, like a pebble thrown in the air. I came back to say goodbye to Mother. That tumor they found in her skull was supposed to keep her alive for only 1 month, enough for me to come back and lay her down to rest. However, she lived for 2 more years. It was just the two of us in this apartment, me and her tumor. We shared our days in this room, sometimes walking downstairs and glistening under the fountain in the garden. Me reading, tumor nodding and asking me for a release, but I refused to grant one. Tumor understood and obeyed. I spoke to the apathy in her eyes and to the tumor. The fountain water would occasionally splash dead mosquitoes on her gray dress. I wiped them. From time to time she tried to talk, but that sounded only like croaking followed by a gasping cough and drooling. My 1 month return home turned into 2 years, which then turned into a lifetime. I stayed by her side all that time, and I stayed when she passed on. I stayed thereafter. 1959. That photograph right there, yes, oily and yellow. The last photograph of me. The last photograph of this building while it was still alive. A few years before that, I managed to buy the building from previous owners for a very cheap price. They wanted to sell it quickly, and frankly, no one was interested in buying an old decrepit house. No one but me. Little by little, all residents have moved out. You can see the house in the background in that photograph, Only our window was lit, others dark. Like an eternal pendulum, I remained the sole beating heart of the house. Hollow echoes of the room coughed harder, turning the moribund space into a compilation of sibilating blasts. She plays parrot with them. I am sensing the end. Child, come closer, closer, a little closer. She is lifting the sateen veil off her face, and for a moment stares into the emptiness of the room, with memories curling up like coils of white smoke, then drifting towards me. I catch them all. I am gliding right above her. I am imbibing her memories. I am an infant popping soap bubbles. Her last thoughts are pulsating like concluding baritone of the tall clock, pushing into its final slow motion ticks. I can hear her. Time. It plays with musical notes on her faces, hops between waves onto the parched shells of her lips, toys with the crest of her wrinkles, then jeers upwards with hissing sighs. I come closer, closer, and a little closer. Until my curls become hers, until my young body and hers become one. Her voice, her face, and that empty apathy in her eyes turns into a childish curiosity. Blooming flowers tessellate the raptured skin, like a warm spring rain after a dry winter. The world is new again. The house takes its last breath and dies. The elderly woman's head rests on the armchair. They die together, and the speck of light slowly floats out her chest towards me. I reach out, and I catch it. The speck of light, the same one that you, the intruder, saw moments ago behind the gate. The same light that ignited your curiosity and made you climb over the gates through the misty garden, down the forking path to the staircase upstairs, to the apartment through the corridor, to this very room, only to find nothing here. By then I will be already gone. I will have already bid my farewell to the dead house and parted with the garden and the gates and the needled junipers and the derelict fountain. I am outside the gates now. I stride merrily down the street to the Market Square on my way to a new life. I am ready to live again. My name is Adrian, and I am alive. This story happened when I was about 13 years old. It was a hot summer afternoon, and my buddy and I were bored and looking for something to do. For the purposes of this story, I will refer to my friend as Hank. Hank's older brother heard us talking about how bored we were and suggested that we go down to the river bottoms and check out the area where the devil worshippers hung out, just to creep ourselves out. I had heard my older brother talk about some blood cult or devil worshippers hanging around the river bottoms as well. So when Hank's older brother mentioned this to us, my interest was piqued. Being young and stupid, Hank and I were always interested in things that were scary, especially if it involved local gossip, so we decided to go. It also helped ease our fears knowing that it was still light outside and would remain light for a few more hours because it was the summertime. According to Hank's older brother, the devil worshippers only came out at night, so we should be safe, I told Hank. At the time, the town that I lived in was small, and the river bottoms only had a few isolated houses that were separated by several acres of farmland. So there really wasn't a lot down there, and my expectations for finding anything interesting were pretty low. As Hank and I made our way down the road that led to the hill nicknamed Devil's Curb, we talked lightly about the things that our older brothers had said about the devil worshippers. We both believed that a bunch of weirdos probably went and did drugs and some other stupid stuff. But neither of us thought that animal or human sacrifice were some of the events that occurred down there. Our plan was to walk down Devil's Curb, investigate a few areas in the river bottoms, and then return home before it got too dark. However, we were not prepared for the things that we would see. As we approached Devil's Curb, Hank and I noticed a foul stench in the air. It smelled like something rotting. It kind of reminded me of the smell of a dead deer when I would go deer hunting. It wasn't incredibly potent, and it was common for deer to come down from the nearby mountains and become roadkill, so the smell of a dead deer did not seem too out of place. For the sake of this story, it's important that I give you a brief physical layout description of Devil's Curb. It is a paved road with a switchback hill that if you start at the top, you will find yourself going straight down in a southern direction and then tightly turning into a westward direction. Then, after traveling about 30 feet, you will make another tight turn that faces you in a southeasterly direction, and you will go another 15 feet until you are in the river bottoms. Now that you have that imagery, I will continue. Hank and I found the source of the smell, which indeed was a dead deer, laying off the side of the road before the first switchback that turns you toward the west. Again, this would normally not be of any concern. However, the deer had a thick rope around its neck. It had been gutted, and its legs were missing. At first, I just thought that it was some unethical hunters, and it may have been. But then Hank and I noticed all the other dead animals surrounding the area. A dead raccoon, several dead squirrels, a few dead cats, and what looked like the rotting corpse of a very large dog. That one bothered me the most. There were things that were out of place, such as an old record player, a blood-stained pulpit, several knives and hatchets, and a few pestles and mortars lying around. This should have been enough warning for us to go back home. But again, we were young and stupid, and so we didn't. Instead, we kept our plan and continued down Devil's Curb to the west. As we transcended, the hair on the back of my neck was standing up, and I was anxious to know what else we would find. Before the road switched back to the southeastern direction that led to the river bottoms, Hank and I again walked off the road and into a small, secluded section that overlooked most of the farmland and the river bottoms to the east, south, and west of us. There was a 20-foot ascending cliff to our backs that rose up to the same elevation before you could begin walking down Devil's Curb. Again, there was a serious stench in the air that reminded both of us of rotting flesh. However, this time the smell was overwhelming and made both of us nauseous to the point that we became dizzy and nearly vomited. In addition, what caused most of us the horror was what we found lying at our feet. There were several tarps rolled up hot dog style with something rolled up inside of them. This was undoubtedly where the source of the smell was coming from. After discovering the tarps, Hank and I immediately looked at each other. Hank's face was pale, and I saw absolute terror on his face. I began to feel like someone was watching us, and when I told Hank this, he started nodding his head frantically, and then loudly whispered, "I know, I feel it too." Before either of us discussed this matter anymore, or even thought about doing something asinine like opening up the tarps to peer inside, I began sprinting back up to Devil's Curb with Hank following closely at my heels. Once we reached the top of the hill, I continued dashing in the direction of home. I heard Hank screaming after me, telling me to stop, so I slowed down, but I was afraid to turn around and see what was the matter. That's when Hank grabbed my shoulder and forced me to turn around. "Look over there," Hank shrilled, pointing next to the top of Devil's Curb. When I looked in that direction, I saw what Hank was pointing at. Standing about a football field length away from us was a woman in a white wedding dress. She was staring directly at us. Again, there were no houses anywhere nearby. No cars and no streets, other than the one that Hank and I were standing on. No explanation as to why a woman would be standing in the middle of nowhere, wearing a wedding dress, alone. However, the worst part is that she was standing and looking over that 20-foot cliff, exactly where Hank and I were when we saw the tarps. I knew at that moment that she had been watching us, but for how long, and why, and what was she doing? Why was she there? We were close enough to her that we could see that her stare was fixed on us, but we were too far away to determine any facial features or if she was smiling or glaring. We stopped running and continued to walk back home, suspiciously looking over our shoulders every few seconds to see if she was still there. She was, and she was staring at us until we were out of view. The nausea and dizziness Hank and I felt gradually went away until we returned to his house. We both agreed to not tell our parents for fear of getting in trouble. That night, I kept dreaming of going to Devil's Curb, and looking around the area, I just couldn't seem to get it out of my head. It was a little bit past 3 a.m. when I was awakened by something. It wasn't a noise, I just felt like someone was close by, and I had always been a light sleeper. Then I looked down at the foot of my bed and saw her, the lady in the white wedding dress. She was hovering, or levitating, and once again staring directly at me. My blinds were open, so the full moon shone in my room, lighting it up enough for me to see her, except I couldn't see her face. I could only tell that she was glaring or scowling at me. I wasn't quite sure. Maybe she was mad that I had been at Devil's Curb and found something that I shouldn't have. Maybe she just hated punk teenage boys, or maybe... I have no idea what she was doing there. All I know is that she levitated at the foot of my bed and I couldn't move. My fear was so powerful that I thought I would pass out or die. I decided to close my eyes, and somehow I was able to throw the sheets over my head. I was hoping that I would fall asleep and that she would leave me alone. But all I could envision was her staring at me, peering deep into my soul with a menacing and hateful expression. It felt like an eternity, but eventually, daylight crept in through my window as the sun began to rise just before 6 a.m. I slowly pulled the sheets from over my head, half expecting her to still be there, but she wasn't. As I looked around, there was no one in my room. I never saw the lady in the white wedding dress again, and I hope that I never do. I have told a few people about this experience, and nobody can give me a good explanation as to why she would be standing where she was, alone and in a white wedding dress. I don't know if she had any sinister intentions, but I'm glad that nothing bad happened to Hank or to me. I also don't know if it was just a bad dream when I saw her levitating at the foot of my bed, or if it even really happened. Either way, I learned that it's best that you stay away from things that are evil, even if you don't know what they are.